Where does your favorite candidate for any office stand on immigration? It's an important question in our time, and for many voters, the first question asked. This is a moment in history when people who live here but were not born here are under a great deal of scrutiny. And not just in the United States. Witness the rise of nationalist movements in France, in England, and in Germany, among others. Our guest this hour examines the trends, both the realities and the reactions. Sasha Polakow-Saransky is the author of Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. Sasha is an Oxford-trained historian and former op-ed editor at The New York Times. His shorter writing has appeared in many publications, and he's the author of another book about Israel's relationship with South Africa during apartheid. Sasha Polakow-Saransky, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, this is such a big issue with so many different facets. I'm wondering how you even settled upon an approach to the book in the first place.
Well, it's a tough question, and I think I had to choose some countries. And I started the research for this just as the refugee crisis was starting in Europe in the summer of 2015. And so while it's affected almost every country in Europe and beyond Europe, I decided to focus on countries like France and Germany and Holland and Denmark that we tend to think of as progressive, especially in the case of Denmark and Holland, as countries that are sort of models for progressive politics, yet these far-right parties were gaining ground there and becoming much more influential in the immigration debate. And I wanted to focus on those sorts of countries rather than places like, say, Poland or Hungary, which have had very troubling trends and anti-democratic populist politicians. But we don't tend to look at those countries in the same way as a place like Holland or Denmark.
There is another book that is mentioned in your book a few times, The Camp of the Saints. And I wonder if you see your book as something of an antidote to that.
I would hope so. I mean, The Camp of the Saints is a novel that came out in the 70s in France and was largely forgotten in the decades in between, but has become quite popular in the last few years among far-right anti-immigration politicians and many voters opposed to immigration. And it's sort of a dystopian novel that envisions hundreds of thousands of refugees landing on the southern shores of France. And the writer, Jean Raspail, has become a sort of cult hero to the far-right. And they see him as a prophet because they think he envisioned what is currently happening in Europe.
I have indicated in some of the billboards in which we talk about this interview coming up that the viewpoint from several different sides, nobody goes unscathed in this book, and left or right. Let's start with the right, because you say you are correct. Far-right leaders are correct that immigration does create problems, but what is their what about their approach to that creates the problems in addition?
Well, what I would argue is that they're the primary problem, right? The far-right leaders are always saying immigration is the problem, but the backlash against it in liberal democratic societies, I would argue, is a far greater threat. So when we talk about this, we should also be talking about how those groups and those parties threaten a country like the United States or a country like France or Holland or Germany when they gain a significant share of the vote and start to drive the debate. And I think that in a lot of these cases, these are parties that are not particularly committed to liberal democratic ideas, to constitutions, to the idea of protecting minority groups' rights, to the rule of law, to independent courts. All they really care about is what they view as the voice of the people at any given moment. And they see themselves as the voice of the people at this particular moment. And so if the current preference in society is to kick all immigrants out, which it is in some of these places, then they say, well, that's the democratic will of the people, and so be it. And I think that that's very dangerous because it ignores a lot of institutions and traditions that have been built up over centuries in democratic societies. And democracy is not just about having 50% of the vote plus one and doing whatever you want. We have checks and balances, and we have institutions that are important in liberal democracies, whether in the United States or Europe. And my fear is that this far-right backlash would happily do away with a lot of that.
So I mean, I guess a question here then becomes, are they sort of naturally anti-immigration, or do they see the response to immigration as an opportunity to advance an agenda that was already in existence?
That's a very good question. I would say it's a bit of both. I think that it has been a tremendous political gift to them that so many refugees were flooding into Europe in late 2015, because they had been arguing this already. It was already present, as you just said, but it hadn't really caught on politically. And then suddenly there were a million Syrians and others coming into Europe, and they said, see, we've been telling you this for years. We're now under threat, and we're facing an Islamic invasion, and this is what we've been warning you about. So it was very politically convenient. And what they also did at that moment is they conflated refugees who were desperately fleeing from ISIS and other terrorist groups with terrorists who were committing crimes in the name of ISIS in Europe. And in the minds of voters, that idea that these groups were one and the same caught on, because the refugees happened to be from the same religious group and the same geographic region as some of these people committing terrorist acts. And so once that conflation took hold, then people started blaming refugees and immigrants for everything that was happening, even though in places like France and Belgium, some of these terrorist attacks were perpetrated by French and Belgian citizens and had nothing to do with anyone who had come from Syria.
And as we point out, there's no viewpoint uncritiqued in this book. So where do you think the left makes a mistake in the response to what the right wing does with immigration?
I think they've ignored the grievances of voters for too long in many of these countries. I think that the grievances and the issues were sort of swept under the rug for 10 or 20 years. And a lot of politicians on the center left and on the left said, yeah, there's some problems, but it's not such a big deal. Or you should just deal with it, to voters who had supported them for years. And a lot of those voters then started to get turned off and to flee from Labour parties, Social Democratic parties, and in some cases the Communist Party in France, and these voters started to go to the far right. And so that happened as a result of left-wing and center-left politicians just not listening to their concerns. And I think that there's a way that the left could have listened to them. It doesn't necessarily mean caving into every demand that every voter makes of you, but I think a lot of people felt like they weren't even being listened to, and that drove them into the arms of these far-right parties.
Okay, there's a whole lot more still to unpack with Sasha Polakow-Saransky, the author of Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and the discussion and invite you to join us by phone or email in a minute 10. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, we're talking about immigration with Sasha Polakow-Saransky, historian and journalist, author of the book Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy, focuses on some of the countries we know best in Western Europe and what has happened to the politics in those countries as the concerns about immigration have arisen. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Sasha, you cite thinkers from Immanuel Kant to Fareed Zakaria in the present time. What did Fareed Zakaria say about the important difference between constitutional liberalism and democracy? It gets back to the 50% plus one you were just talking about a few minutes ago.
Yeah, so Zakaria wrote a book about almost 15 years ago now called The Future of Freedom, where he explored this issue. And what he was warning about in this book is the assumption that liberalism and democracy always go hand in hand. And what he argued is that, in fact, they often don't. And there are a lot of illiberal democracies throughout the world, and we can see this in places like Hungary and Turkey. Some people would argue in India today, you have democracies where people are voting and electing people, but those leaders are not necessarily liberals, and they don't believe in liberal values. And so what he was warning against is this assumption that they always go together, and the dangers of what happens when those two things part ways and you have democracy without liberalism. And I think that that's what you're starting to see in a lot of these populist parties in Europe today, is a complete commitment to the idea of democracy in its simplest and crudest majoritarian sense, that if we have the majority, we do what we like, but no commitment to the values and institutions and constitutions that most modern liberal democracies have and value. And so I think that they've been able to market themselves very effectively by saying, we speak for you, the angry and disillusioned people, And they've gained a lot of votes that way, but their notion of democracy is very much what Zakaria was warning against, this kind of illiberal democracy.
So in the example of, say, France and Marine Le Pen, does she appeal to people by downplaying anything that sounds racist and assuring them, no, we're not racist, we're speaking for the people?
She does, and she does it very well. I met Le Pen in the course of the research for this book and spent some time with her. She's a very savvy politician. She's a very strategic politician, and she sends that message all the time to voters. And one of the ways that she does it is to say, I'm nothing like my father. Yes, my father may have been a bit of an anti-Semite, but now the Front National, our political party, has nothing to do with that legacy, and we welcome Jewish voters and we welcome gay voters, and indeed some of her key advisors during the campaign were gay. And so she's trying to distance herself from that. There are also, of course, some pretty unsavory people in the party still who have links to that darker past in her party, but she's tried to distance herself from them publicly and emphasize this sort of new model. I call it a rebranding, and I think that she's done it more effectively than some other politicians, but you see this happening everywhere in Holland, in Denmark. These parties that have been around for a while are afraid of being associated with the nastier legacies of the far right. So they distance themselves from skinheads and neo-Nazis, and they say, we have nothing to do with that. We're a new modern right, and we're speaking for the people, and we just don't want immigrants in the country. And it's working in a lot of places. People are starting to believe that they're genuinely different. I would argue that in many cases they're not, and they still harbor a lot of those same ideas from the past, but you do have to give them credit on some level for the way that they've rebranded, because it has translated into votes for them.
You mentioned Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was actually the founder of the Front National, and it must have been a stroke of genius for her to eject her father from the very party he created on the basis of his anti-Semitism.
Absolutely. She, like I said, she's a very strategic politician. I have no idea what conversations they had in private about that, but it was a political masterstroke, because for voters who couldn't stomach the father, seeing him ejected like that and seeing her distance herself and the party from some of those ideas suddenly made it acceptable politically. And I think that that explains to a large extent why she won 33% of the vote when her father only won 18% 15 years earlier.
And that was the presidential election in France. We're talking to Sasha Polakow-Saransky about Go Back to Where You Came From, his book, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. And divided in sections, number one, from strangers to outcasts, section two, from outcasts to terrorists, section three, from terrorists to usurpers, section four, the new normal. So in section one, you give us a history lesson, starting with the Dutch in Indonesia. When the Dutch left there, who did they bring along with them back to the Netherlands?
Well, they had allies in their colonial war there, and some of those came along to Holland. They're actually not a significant part of the immigrant population in Holland today, but it was one of the first foreign populations that arrived in Holland. And what's happened since then, this episode we're talking about is in the mid to late 1940s, but in the 60s and 70s, Holland started to see a lot of immigration from countries like Turkey and Morocco that had no colonial connection whatsoever, but they came as guest workers, and a lot of them ended up staying, and their descendants are now Dutch, and many of them are Dutch citizens, and they're there to stay. And a lot of the friction that you see in society and a lot of the debates currently happening in Dutch politics are centered around those immigrants and the descendants of those initial guest workers who came in the 60s and 70s. And what you hear from these nationalist, xenophobic politicians like Geert Wilders, the leader of the Dutch far-right party, he has slogans in the campaign. He used slogans like de-Islamize now. He called Moroccan Dutch people scum in a public forum. And so the kind of rhetoric being used about immigrants and descendants of immigrants in Western Europe today is very scary, I would argue, in many ways, and reminiscent of the kinds of rhetoric that was used in earlier generations against Jews in many European countries.
You mentioned guest workers, and this is really a key to things, because at one time, immigration was really the right-wing position, the way you paint it in the book.
Absolutely. So in the early days, there was quite a lot of opposition from unions and socialist parties and center-left parties aligned with the unions because they were afraid of competition from incoming immigrants with local working-class voters who supported their parties. And that has shifted over the years in most countries, including the U.S., I would say. And so back then, the right wing was saying, oh, let's keep the borders open. It's an opportunity for cheap labor to come in. And that argument has almost disappeared from debates in Europe. I think you still see some of it, perhaps even in your part of the country, from conservatives who are happy to have immigrants coming in and doing jobs at a lower wage for them. But in Europe, you hardly hear it anymore. The right's position has become very strongly anti-immigration, and the left in many ways has become the voice of immigrant groups and their descendants.
So a major issue here is that several European countries did bring in large groups of people. Was there ever any intention to make these people citizens?
They didn't really think about it, to be honest, and I think that when you look back at this historically, that's one of the more surprising things about it. I think that they genuinely didn't expect them to stay and didn't have a long view of what sorts of issues and challenges might develop. And so one of the other things I look into in the book is this question of integration, because I think that no matter what one's position on immigration numbers is, if you care about living in a successful, multi-ethnic, democratic society, then integration really matters. And I think in the early days, they didn't think about it much. And when they started to think about it in a lot of European countries, the numbers had grown quite a bit, and it was difficult. And so I think that even now, you see a sort of reluctance to really talk seriously and think seriously about it, what it means to have a multi-ethnic society in this day and age in Europe, and how to integrate people who may have been there for quite a long time but don't feel part of society, or whom the majority of Germans or Dutch people don't view as equal citizens. And so it can be something as simple as how someone refers to someone on the street. They'll point out a Dutch person whose parents came from Morocco and say, that Arab guy. It's very rare to hear someone talk about them as a Dutch person in the same way that they would point to a blonde-haired Dutch person across the street. And so even in the casual daily references, you see a sort of lack of acceptance of immigrants and people descended from immigrants as equally Dutch or German or French.
Well, and the way you describe this in the book, it sounds like the existing populations did what happened in American cities with white flight in the middle of the 20th century.
There was quite a lot of white flight. The geographies are different in a lot of these European cities. I mean, so in some cases, Moroccans and Turks would move into a neighborhood and the white people living there would move out further into the suburbs. Something different happened in France in a lot of cases. You have ghettos in the suburbs of Paris, for instance, that are almost entirely immigrants and people who are of immigrant descent, and you know they're very concentrated there, and it's very poor, and it's very isolated from public transport and from the networks that you need to succeed in a city like Paris. And so you have those sorts of pockets on the outskirts of lots of European cities where people have just sort of been deposited and forgotten about.
Sasha Polakow-Saransky is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, historian, journalist, former op-ed editor of the New York Times. He has written a book about immigration and its effect in particularly Western Europe called Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. You can join our conversation on the Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And here again, criticism not just for the folks on the right who insist that everything that could possibly be wrong with the world is because of these people living amidst us, but you also criticize the left for responses. Now, do you see reluctance in country after country on the left to discuss any downside to immigration?
Yes, I think that in a lot of places that's a problem. There are certain politicians who I think are taking it seriously. And so if you look at France now, for instance, the new president of France, Emmanuel Macron, has made some tough choices. And he's still coming up with his policy agenda, but he is probably going to deport some people who are illegally in France. He's probably going to limit immigration numbers in some way or another, but do it in a way that is committed to liberal democratic values. So his argument is not going to be kick them out because they're ruining our society or they're a threat to our society or all of these immigrants are terrorists, which is what Marine Le Pen and a lot of people on the right are trying to tell voters. I see him saying something quite different, which is not everyone in the world can come here. We welcome immigrants, but in a certain number and at a certain pace, because otherwise our society can't absorb them. And you can look at a country like Canada for something similar. I mean, Canada, the prime minister welcomes refugees at the airport, yet they also have a regulated immigration system, and not everyone in the world can just show up in Canada. So I think that what you see on the left is there's sort of a division between people who just shrug their shoulders and say, it's never a problem, let everyone come, it will all work out, which I think is the sort of attitude that really alienated a lot of voters who used to vote for left and center-left parties. And then these sort of more modern left politicians, people like Macron or Trudeau in Canada, who say, you know, we welcome refugees and it's part of our heritage and our country and our values to welcome refugees and help people who are fleeing war and to welcome other immigrants, but we can't take everyone in the world, and so there have to be limits. And I think that is a smarter form of politics and one that will hold off some of these far-right parties in the long run, because it's talking about the problem honestly, but it's staying firmly committed to liberal democratic values at the same time.
Is it a harder argument to make, though, because it requires some rather finer slicing of...
Absolutely, yeah.
All right. Let's take a call here. Jamie in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sasha Polakos-Aransky.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Sasha, this might seem like a little bit of a stretch, but my question relates to the writings and the philosophy of Ayn Rand, a libertarian and presumably right-wing in regard about that. Could you compare and contrast her philosophy of selfishness with that of, say the Austrians who have just recently elected somebody who has neo-Nazi tendencies? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Jamie. Sasha, what do you got there?
Well, I'm not a keen follower or reader of Ayn Rand, but I know the basics of her philosophy and libertarian views on some of these issues. And what I would say on this question, since the caller brought up Austria, it's interesting to look at some other leading libertarian thinkers like Hayek, who wrote about this in earlier generations and also warned about the threat from the far right and how far right backlash against immigration could destabilize liberal societies and democratic societies. And so it's interesting to see the sorts of strange bedfellows that you get on this issue. And you pointed to that in some of the questions you raised earlier in our discussion. This doesn't always come out clearly as a left-wing issue or a right-wing issue. And so one of the things you'll find in the U.S. and in Europe today is libertarians, and often people who are followers of Ayn Rand or subscribe to some of her ideas, will be quite open to the idea of immigration on the grounds that there should be open borders and people should be free to move. And that will cut across political lines because these people might be very far to the right on certain other issues. And likewise, you'll find people on the left who are afraid of immigration because they think it will undercut the wages of local workers, and they're concerned about the working class, in whether it's in Britain or in Denmark or France, and they say this is a threat to our way of life and we shouldn't be sharing our hard-won resources. So that's about as much detail as I can go into off the top of my head about the caller's question, but I would say that it's an interesting point to raise, because the assumption that libertarians and especially you know, people who like to quote Ayn Rand are necessarily going to be hostile to some of these ideas. It doesn't always, the cards don't always fall that way. And I think that I've certainly had some very interesting conversations and surprising ones with libertarians who disagree with me about a lot of other issues.
Sasha, I want to get into section two of the book now, from Outcast to Terrorist. There's an amazing moment in here where you describe a Danish member of parliament who had to convince Muslim kids that they are Danes already.
Yeah, and this is a woman who is herself, you know, the daughter of immigrants from Turkey, and was talking to some of her local constituents' children down the street, and they had grown up, they didn't speak any language other than Danish, but they didn't see themselves as Danes because the way that they were referred to by everyone else, from the media to their friends and teachers, they were always labeled as Muslims. And so somehow outside of the mainstream of the society and somehow different. And this goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about the way that people name you as an immigrant or as a Muslim or as a foreigner, even though you may have lived in this country for a generation, your family may have been there for multiple generations, but you're still labeled somehow as an outsider. And I think that until European countries get over that and start to see someone as Dutch or Danish, even if their skin's a different color, I think it will be hard to resolve many of these problems.
Sasha Polakow-Saransky, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. You're welcome to get into the conversation as well by phone or email. We'll take calls and emails from you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a barn burner of a discussion about immigration with Sasha Polakow-Saransky, who is an Oxford-trained historian and former op-ed editor at the New York Times. He has written a book called Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. It examines some of the countries we know best in Western Europe and what has happened in discussions about immigration there. And no viewpoint comes out unscathed, right or left. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Sasha, when you look at Western Europe in particular, and country after country where there is this collection of people, sometimes several collections of people of different nationalities originally, who've been living in the country for, in some cases, several generations now, but still are not assimilated. I mean, are the nativist forces correct at some degree that some groups of people are simply incompatible?
I don't think any group is inherently incompatible. And when nativist politicians or thinkers start to argue that, I think it's very dangerous. I think there have been problems with integration, and there has been a lack of effective integration policy, and some groups haven't assimilated very well. But I don't think that has anything to do with the fact that they happen to be Muslim. If you look back into history in the United States, for instance, this is an argument that was made in the 19th century about Catholics in the U.S. In places like Boston, when Irish Catholics started to come in large numbers, there was an argument that they were somehow different from earlier immigrant groups, that they were inherently unassimilable, that they were beholden to the Pope, and that they had these foreign religious customs and that were having lots of children. Again, later in history, you see these arguments applied to Jews, both in the U.S. and in Europe, with devastating consequences. So I think it's very dangerous whenever a politician or a leading intellectual starts to argue that there's something inherent in a specific group's makeup or religion that makes it hard for them to assimilate. That said, I think there are problems in a lot of European countries, and some of that has to do with social isolation and the fact that a lot of these immigrant groups have been ghettoized on the margins of society. Some of it has to do with lousy government policies that were poorly thought through and haven't effectively educated the children of these immigrants. So there's a lot of blame to go around, but I think that we should be very careful about blaming a religion or a nationality alone.
Is there a pathway to correction, do you think? Is there a pathway for the banlieues around Paris to be integrated with the surrounding populations, or vice versa, to have the surrounding populations move into the banlieues, whatever it takes to get people assimilated?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, a lot of people in France would say that, you know, the education system was the linchpin of integration and the creation of a national identity. But when you have schools that are poor and isolated and where 90% of the students are from immigrant groups, it's not going to help very much. And likewise, when you have concentrations of wealthy white French people in the nicest parts of Paris going to the same schools, there's not going to be much mixing. So some of this is social policy, and I don't see France imposing forced busing, for instance, anytime soon, the way that the United States has at certain moments in history. But I think that there are other ways to do it in terms of giving people access to schools in different areas, to aggressively promoting access to higher education for groups that have been disadvantaged or marginalized. There are solutions, but I think a lot of these governments haven't really been willing to face up to the problem and some of the costs of what it would take to really effectively integrate people. And I think that to be fair, some of the community leaders and some of these groups aren't particularly interested in either, and that's also a problem. And so I think we have to look at this really as a sort of individual level thing. How at a very young age can you teach the child of a Syrian immigrant who's just come to Germany fluent German in a good public school that gives him or her access to a good high school and a good job and potentially a higher education? I mean, these are things that can start very early and that governments can do. And what's interesting in Germany in particular is even some of the politicians in Merkel's party who were against her immigration policy and who really opposed the welcoming of huge numbers of refugees in 2015, once they were there, they said, okay, well, now our job is to integrate them as effectively as possible. And maybe it won't help our economy for 10 or even 20 years, but that's what we have to do now. And for me, hearing that from people who are very much on the right politically is encouraging, and it distinguishes them from people on the right who say Muslims will never integrate into our society, they're inherently incompatible, we should send them home. Those are two very different arguments that you hear on the political right in Europe today, and to some extent in the U.S. also. And I think that for people on the left who are in favor of immigration, like I am, it's very important to distinguish between those two conservative arguments, because one is committed to a multi-ethnic democratic society, but says maybe we shouldn't have quite as many people coming, and not quite so fast. And the others are saying these people will never be part of our society. They're incapable of it. They should be sent away, and we should stop Europe from becoming Muslim, which is the kind of thing you hear from Geert Wilders or Marine Le Pen. And that's dangerous. So I would just caution people to distinguish between those arguments and listen carefully to what politicians are saying, because not all anti-immigration or people who are arguing for some restriction on immigration are racist reactionaries.
So then how do you figure out the value of something like the sorts of things that that President Trump has been talking about in the United States, like a merit-based system and the end to the family chain kind of system, where if you've got a brother over here, you can come over here, that kind of thing?
Well, I think we have to be very careful. I mean, I find it hard to take the Trump administration seriously on this issue when they say things like that at the same time that they're trying to impose what effectively, when it was conceived, was a ban on Muslim immigration. And it's gone through various iterations since then. But I'm interested in sort of the underlying values behind a policy. And I think that what I see in this administration is an effort to keep certain people out based on their religious heritage or their national origin. And that's dangerous. I think that if that's not the underlying motivation, and people say, well, you can't bring a family of 10 people over to live with one relative because that's going to be too much of a burden on the system, that's a legitimate argument. But I just find it very difficult to trust an administration whose motives seem to be somewhere else entirely.
All right, let's take another call here. We have Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sasha Polakow-Saransky.
Hi there. Good morning. Sort of, obviously, the subject is close to my heart. But I also, I sent an email talking about the Nuremberg laws, which stripped Jews of citizenship and therefore allowed the Nazis to do anything they wanted. But the other subject that I find more, it's a larger picture, that the countries to which immigrants come have a history of colonialism or what's called economic assassination of other countries from where these people come. So, like, France has a history in North Africa. You know, in Germany we had Greek and Italian and Turkish there, like Ingolstadt, the place where they built the Audis, there's a huge Turkish population. It's like, you want to get the best Turkish food, that's where you go. Here we have Mexican, South American immigrants. We have the second largest Latino city in North America, L.A., right? So it's, but do they come because they just want to do us harm? No. They come because there's a history of economic abuse, of that's called economical terrorism in a way.
All right, so you're making life tough in the countries in other parts of the world, and then they want to come here because life is better.
You're exploiting those countries, and then you wonder why the hell are those people coming here.
All right, thanks, Wolfgang. Thoughts, Sasha?
Yeah, I think it's complicated. I think that there are some people who may view it as a debt owed to them by wealthy European countries if you're coming, say, from a place like Mali or Senegal, a former colonies of France, and you say, well, our country was looted for centuries, and it's our right now to go to France and to get something back. I mean, I do think that there are people who think that way, but if you look at the Syrian refugee crisis, most of the Syrians who've ended up in large numbers in Germany now don't have a historical connection through colonialism or any other connection to Germany. It's where they ended up. They were fleeing a war. They went through Greece. Greece wasn't in a position to host them or take them. Most of them stayed there for a few weeks and continued north. So I think it's a combination of genuine need and refugees who need a safe place to go to. And Germany was one of the very few countries, along with Sweden, that really opened its doors in a significant way in 2015, and then trying to build a better life. And so it's a complicated thing on a policy level because, as I was saying earlier, a country can't take in every single person in the world who wants to earn a better wage and build a better life. So I think there are some tough choices, like the French president is making now and that Chancellor Merkel in Germany will have to make about whether someone can stay. And I think that here you have to think about international law too. Countries who signed on to the UN Refugee Convention committed to taking people in who were fleeing war and to assess their asylum applications and to grant it. And if a country has signed on to that convention, that's their obligation. And I think a lot of countries right now are trying to duck out of those obligations or pretend that everyone coming is not a refugee, and that's just not the case. There are definitely people who are coming to earn a better living, but there are also a lot of genuine refugees who are fleeing wars, and I think they're going to be a lot more in the years to come, both as a result of future wars. If you look at places like Yemen right now, that could be the next Syrian refugee crisis, could be from Yemen. People are on the verge of starvation there, and if a country like Bangladesh goes underwater due to climate change, or if there's a drought in a country like Egypt, you're going to see huge numbers of people moving, and some of them are going to go to Europe, and some of them are going to go to the U.S., and some of them are going to go to Australia. But I think there are going to be future crises like this, and governments have to get prepared for it.
It does seem like the countries of the world are generally unprepared, though, because I can think of certainly previous periods in history when refugee ships showed up, for example, full of Jews fleeing Europe and got turned away from places like the United States.
Absolutely. And I think people need to remember that. And unfortunately, too many people have forgotten what happened to many German Jews who tried to seek refuge in the U.S. in the mid and late 1930s and were turned back. And as I wrote in the book, many of those people died when they were sent back to Europe or sent to other European countries that were then invaded by the Nazis. And so I think that there's this sort of dismissiveness from many people opposed to immigration, and a lot of those people are on the political right, but not all of them, and from governments too, and saying, oh, you know, like these people are not genuine refugees. They really don't have it so bad. You hear this from some politicians in Europe now who say, oh, we can just send people back to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is safe now. And then some of these people get sent back and they die. And so these are tough decisions. And I think that governments and politicians can't be flippant about it. You know, we're talking about people's lives here. And it's one thing to say, okay, a war has been over in a country for 10 years. Perhaps our obligation to take in refugees from that country has expired, and we should try to facilitate a way for them to go home safely. But when you're trying to kick someone out and send them back to a country that is still dangerous and where their life might still be threatened, either by war or because their particular ethnic group is persecuted, which has been the case for a lot of Afghans who've been sent back, that's people's lives you're playing with. And I don't think that they should just be pawns in social policy debates.
Does it seem like anybody's really got a best way forward that the rest of the countries might crib from?
I think that Merkel's probably the best example, and maybe Macron in France to some extent with what he's doing now. I mean, they're trying to deal with the problem on a very large scale, but they're also trying to do it in a way that is fair. And so I think that Germany and France right now, and to some extent Canada, are probably the best models, but every country is different, and these models might not apply everywhere. But I think in terms of upholding democratic values, I think that they're a real model to look to.
This book is really going to make you think. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. It's the work of Sasha Polakow-Saransky, who joined us today in the exchange. Sasha, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care.